This is a reading of the book Theosophy by Rudolf Steiner, chapter 2, entitled Destiny and the Reincarnation of the Spirit. The soul lives and acts in the middle ground between body and spirit. The impressions reaching the soul through the body are fleeting, present only as long as the body's organs are open to the things of the outside world. My eyes perceive the color of a rose only as long as they are open and face to face with the rose. The presence of both the outer world object and the bodily organ is necessary in order for an impression, a sensation, or a perception to come about. However, what I recognize in my spirit as true about the rose does not pass away with the present moment. This truth is not at all dependent on me. It would be true even if I had never experienced that rose. Whatever I may recognize through the spirit is grounded in an element of the soul's life that connects the soul to a universal content, a content that reveals itself within the soul, but is independent of its transitory bodily basis. Whether this content is imperishable in every respect does not matter. What matters is that it be revealed in such a way that the soul's independent, imperishable aspect, rather than its perishable bodily basis, is involved. The soul's enduring aspect comes into view as soon as we become aware of experiences that are not limited by its transitory aspect. Here, too, the important point is not whether these experiences first come to consciousness through transitory bodily processes, but whether they contain something that, although it lives in the soul, still possesses a truth independent of any transitory perceptual process. The soul stands between the present and the permanent, in that it occupies the middle ground between body and spirit. However, it also mediates between the present and the permanent. It preserves the present for remembrance, wresting it away from perishability and giving it a place in the permanence of its own spiritual nature. The soul also puts the stamp of permanence on the temporal and temporary, since it does not simply give itself up to fleeting stimuli, but also determines things out of its own initiative, incorporating its own essence into the actions it carries out. Through memory, the soul preserves yesterday. Through action, it prepares tomorrow. If my soul were not able to hold the red color of the rose through memory, it would have to perceive this red over and over again to be conscious of it. But whatever remains after the external impression is gone, whatever my soul can retain, can once again become a mental image or representation, independent of the external impression. Through this ability, my soul turns the outer world into its own inner world by retaining the outer world through memory and continuing to lead an inner life with it, independent of any impressions acquired in the past. Thus, the life of the soul becomes a lasting consequence of the transitory impressions made by the outer world. But actions too acquire permanence, once they have been stamped on the outer world. When I cut a branch from a tree, something that happens because of my soul totally changes the course of events in the outer world. Something quite different would have happened to that branch had I not intervened with my action. I have called up a series of consequences that would not have been present without me, and what I have done today will remain in effect tomorrow. It has become lasting through my action, just as yesterday's impressions have become lasting for my soul through memory. In our ordinary consciousness, we do not usually form a concept of, quote, becoming lasting through action, close quote, in the same way that we form a concept of memory, of becoming lasting as a result of observation or perception. But is the I, capital, not just as strongly linked to a change in the world that results from its own action, as it is to a memory that results from an impression? The I assesses new impressions differently, according to the memories it has, or does not have, of one thing or of another. As an I, however, it also enters into another relationship with the world that depends on whether it has carried out a certain action or another. Whether or not I made an impression on someone else through something I have done depends on the presence or absence of something in the relationship of the world to my I. I am a different person in my relationship to the world once I have made an impression on my environment. We do not notice this as easily as we notice how the I changes through acquiring a memory. But this is only because as soon as a memory is formed, it unites with the overall life of the soul we have always regarded as our own, while the external consequence of an action, released from this soul life, goes on working through after effects that are quite different from what we can remember about the action. In spite of this, we must admit that something is now in the world as a result of our completed action, something whose character has been stamped on it by the I. Thinking this through carefully, we arrive at a question. Could it be that the results of our actions, whose character has been impressed on them by the I, have a tendency to come back to the I in the same way that an impression preserved in memory comes to life again when an outer circumstance evokes it? What is preserved in memory is waiting for a reason to reappear. Could it be the same with things in the outer world that have been made lasting by the character of the I? Are they waiting to approach the soul from outside, just as a memory waits for a reason to approach from inside? This is only posed here as a question, since these results, laden with the character of our I, may well never have any reason or opportunity to meet our soul again. However, if we follow this line of thought carefully, we can immediately see that such results could exist, and by their very existence determine the relationship of the world to the I. The next thing to investigate is whether anything in human life suggests that this conceptual possibility points to an actual reality. Looking first at memory, we can ask how it comes about. Obviously, the process is quite different from how sensation or perception comes about. Without eyes, I could not have the sensation of blue. However, my eyes do not give me any memory of the blue. For them to provide the sensation, something blue must be in view at this moment. My bodily nature would allow all impressions to sink back down into oblivion if something were not also taking place in the relationship between the outer world and my soul, namely the formation of a current mental image through the act of perception, with the result that through inner processes I may later again have a mental image of something that originally brought about a mental image from outside. Maybe that portion of the sentence again, I'm sorry. I may later again have a mental image of something that originally brought about a mental image from outside. People who have become practiced at observing the soul will realize that it is all wrong to say that if I have a mental image today, the same mental image shows up again tomorrow in my memory, having stayed somewhere inside me in the meantime. On the contrary, the mental image that I have right now is a phenomenon that passes away with the present moment. But if memory intervenes, a process takes place in me that is the result of something additional that has gone on in the relationship between me and the outer world, something other than the evoking of the current mental image. The old mental image has not been stored, in quotes, anywhere. The one my memory calls up is a new one. Remembering means being able to visualize something anew. It does not mean that a mental image can come to life again. What appears today is something different from the original mental image. This point is being made because, in the field of spiritual science, it is necessary to form more precise concepts about certain things than we do in ordinary life or even in ordinary science. Remembering means experiencing something that is no longer there, linking a past experience to my present life. This happens in every instance of remembering. Suppose I meet someone I recognize because I met him or her yesterday. This person would be a total stranger to me if I could not link the image formed through yesterday's perception to my impression of today. Today's image is given to me by perception, that is, by my sensory system. But who conjures up yesterday's image into my soul? It is the same being in me who was present at both yesterday's encounter and today's. Throughout the preceding discussion, this being has been called, quote, the soul, close quote. Without this trusty keeper of the past, every external impression would be a new one for us. The soul imprints on the body the process by which something becomes a memory. However, the soul must first do the imprinting and then perceive its imprint just as it perceives something outside itself. In this way, the soul is the keeper of memory. As the keeper of the past, the soul is continually collecting treasures for the spirit. My ability to distinguish right from wrong is due to the fact that, as a human being, I am a thinking being capable of grasping truth in my spirit. The truth is eternal. Even if I were continually losing sight of the past and each impression were new to me, the truth could still always reveal itself to me again in things. But the spirit in me is not restricted to the impressions of the moment. My soul widens the spirit's field of vision to include the past. And the more my soul can add to the spirit from the past, the richer the spirit becomes. The soul passes on to the spirit what it has received from the body. Thus, at every moment of its life, the human spirit carries two very different elements. First, the eternal laws of the true and the good. Second, the recollection of past experiences. Whatever it does is accomplished under the influence of these two factors. Therefore, if we want to understand a human spirit, we must know two different things about it. First, how much of the eternal has been revealed to it, and second, how many treasures from the past it holds. These treasures do not remain in an unchanged form for the spirit, however. The impressions we gain from experience gradually fade from memory, but their fruits do not. For example, we do not remember all the experiences we went through as children, learning to read and write, but we would not be able to read or write now if we had not had these experiences, and if their fruits had not been preserved in the form of abilities. This is how the spirit transforms its treasure trove of memories. It abandons to fate anything that can lead only to images of individual experiences, keeping only the power to heighten its own abilities. We can be sure that not a single experience goes to waste, since the soul preserves each one as a memory, and the spirit extracts from each one whatever it can use to enhance its abilities and enrich its life. The human spirit grows as these experiences are worked over and assimilated. Thus, although we do not find our past experiences preserved in the spirit as if in a treasure vault, we do find their effects in the abilities we have acquired. Until now, we have been considering the spirit and the soul only between birth and death. But we cannot leave it at that. That would be like considering the human body only within these same confines. Of course, much can be discovered within them, but we will never be able to explain the human form through what exists between birth and death. This gestalt cannot build itself up directly out of mere physical substances and forces. It must descend from another form, or gestalt, like itself, that has come about through reproduction. Physical substances and forces build up the body during its lifetime, while the forces of reproduction enable it to bring forth another body of the same form, that is, one that can be the carrier of the same life body. Every life body is a repetition of its immediate ancestor. And because this is so, the form the life body assumes is never arbitrary, but is the one that it has inherited. The forces that have made my human form possible came from my ancestors. But the human spirit also assumes a definite form, or gestalt. Parenthesis, the words are, of course, being used here in a spiritual sense. Close parenthesis. And human spiritual forms are as different as they can possibly be. No two individuals have the same spiritual form. Our observation in this realm must be as calm and objective as it is on the physical plane. We cannot maintain that the spiritual differences in people result only from differences in their environment, their upbringing, and so on. that is not true at all, because two people from similar environments and of similar educational backgrounds can still develop in very different ways. We are forced to admit that they must have begun life with very different endowments. At this point, we are confronted with an important state of affairs, which, if we recognize its full implications, sheds light on the essential nature and constitution of the human being. Of course, if we choose to turn our attention only to the material aspect of events, we could say that the individual differences in human personalities result from genetic differences in the reproductive cells they develop from. If we take into account the laws of heredity discovered by Gregor Mendel and developed further by others, this point of view can indeed seem very plausible and also scientifically justifiable. Such a point of view, however, only demonstrates a lack of insight into how we really relate to our experience. Careful observation of the pertinent details will show that outer circumstances affect different people in different ways through something that never directly interacts with their material development. A precise researcher in this field will see that what proceeds from material potentials is separate and distinct from what may originate in our interaction with our experiences, but takes shape only because the soul itself enters into the interaction. Clearly, the soul relates to something in the outer world that, through its very nature, has no connection to genetic potentials. In our physical form, or gestalt, we are different from the animals, our fellow creatures on the earth. Within certain limits, however, all human beings are of similar form. There is only one human genus and species. No matter how great the differences between races, tribes, peoples, and personalities may be, in all physical respects, the similarity between two human beings is always greater than that between a human being and an animal of any species. Everything that comes to expression in the human species is determined by heredity, passed down from one generation to the next. Our human form is bound to this heredity. Just as a lion can inherit its physical form only from its lion ancestors, we can inherit ours only from our human ancestors. The physical similarity between human beings is apparent to the eye, EYE, and the difference between human spiritual forms is equally apparent to the unbiased spiritual view. This is demonstrated by one very evident fact, that human beings have biographies. If we were nothing more than members of our species, no individual biographies would be possible. A lion or a pigeon is of interest only as a member of the lion or pigeon species. We understand everything essential about the individual once we have described the species. It does not really matter whether we are dealing with a parent, child, or grandchild. What is interesting about them is common to all three generations. What a human individual signifies, however, only begins where he or she stops being merely a member of a genus and species and becomes an individual being. I certainly cannot grasp the essential nature of Mr. John Doe by describing his son or his father. I have to know his own personal biography. If we think about the nature of biography, we will realize that with regard to the spirit, each human being is his or her individual genus. Of course, if, in quotes, biography, is interpreted to mean nothing more than a superficial listing of events and experiences, we might well insist that it would be possible to write the biography of a dog in the same sense as that of a person. However, if a biographer captures a human being's uniqueness, it will be clear that this biography of one human being corresponds to the description of an entire animal species. Obviously, something resembling a biography can be written about an animal, especially an intelligent one, but that is not the point. The point is that a human biography corresponds to the description of an animal species rather than to the biography of an individual animal. Some people will always try to refute statements like this by saying that people who work with animals, zookeepers, for instance, are well aware of individual differences between animals of the same species. Such comments, however, demonstrate only an inability to distinguish individual differences from differences that can be acquired only through individuality. Just as genus and species can be understood in a physical sense only once we grasp that they are determined by heredity, the individual spiritual being can be understood only by means of a similar spiritual heredity. I possess my physical human form because I am descended from human ancestors. But where does what is expressed in my biography come from? As a physical human being, I repeat the form of my ancestors. But what do I repeat as a spiritual human being? If we insist that what my biography encompasses must simply be accepted as it is, that it needs no further explanation, we might as well also claim to have seen a hill out there where lumps of matter stuck themselves together into a living human being. As a physical human being, I am descended from other physical human beings. I have the same form or gestalt as the rest of the human genus. This shows that the characteristics of a genus are acquired within it through heredity. But as a spiritual human being, I have my own particular form, just as I have a personal biography. Therefore, I cannot have acquired this form from anyone other than myself. And, since I came into this world not with general, but with very specific predispositions of soul that have determined the course of my life as revealed by my biography, my work on myself cannot have begun at birth. I must have been present as a spiritual individual before my birth. I was certainly not present in my ancestors, because as spiritual individuals, they are different from me, and their biographies cannot explain mine. Instead, I must, as a spiritual being, be the repetition of one whose biography can explain mine. The only other conceivable possibility would be that I have only a spiritual life before birth or conception to thank for molding what my biography encompasses. This idea would be justifiable, however, only if we were to assume that what works on a human soul from its physical surroundings is of the same character as what the soul receives from a purely spiritual world. This assumption contradicts precise observation, however. What exerts a determining influence on a human soul from its physical surroundings works on it in the same way that a new experience works on a similar earlier experience in our physical life. To observe these relationships correctly, we must learn to perceive that some impressions in human life work on the soul's potentials, in the same way that standing before something still to be done works on what we have already practiced repeatedly in physical life. Rather than affecting abilities acquired through practice in the course of this life, these impressions affect potential abilities of the soul. If we achieve insight into these things, we arrive at the idea of earthly lives that must have preceded this one. In thinking about it, we can no longer be content with assuming that this life is preceded only by purely spiritual experiences. Schiller carried a physical form that he inherited from his ancestors. This physical form could not possibly have grown up out of the earth. The same is true of Schiller as a spiritual individuality. He must have been the repetition of another spiritual being whose biography accounts for his, just as human reproduction accounts for his physical form. The human physical form is a repetition or re-embodiment over and over again of what is inherent in the human genus and species. Similarly, a spiritual individual must be a re-embodiment or reincarnation of one and the same spiritual being, for as a spiritual being, each person is his or her own species. We can object that what has been said here is a mere arrangement of thoughts, and we can demand external proof of it, as we are accustomed to do in the case of ordinary science. However, it must be pointed out that the reincarnation of the spiritual human being is a process that does not belong to the domain of outer physical facts, but takes place exclusively in the spiritual domain, and that of all our ordinary mental powers, only thinking has access to this realm. If we refuse to trust the power of thinking, we will never be able to explain higher spiritual facts to ourselves. But for anyone whose spiritual eye, EYE, is open, the above train of thought is just as compelling as any process taking place in front of our physical eyes. Those who find a so-called, in quotes, proof, constructed along the lines of ordinary scientific knowledge, more persuasive than what has been presented about the significance of biography, may well be great scientists in the usual sense of the word, but they are far removed from the methods of true spiritual research. The attempt to explain a person's spiritual attributes as an inheritance from parents or other ancestors is evidence of a very dubious prejudice indeed. Those who are guilty of assuming that Goethe, for instance, inherited anything essential to his nature from his father and mother will probably not respond to reason, since they harbor a deep antipathy toward unbiased observation. Their materialistic persuasion prevents them from seeing relationships between phenomena in the right light. What has been presented so far provides the prerequisites for tracing our essential being beyond birth and death. Within the confines of birth and death, the human being belongs to the three worlds of bodily nature, soul nature, and spirit nature. The soul forms the link between body and spirit by permeating the body's third member, the soul body, with the capacity for sensation, and, as the consciousness soul, by pervading the first spiritual member, the spirit self. Throughout life, therefore, the soul participates in both body and spirit, and this participation is expressed in all aspects of its existence. The organization of the soul body determines to what extent the sentient soul can unfold its capacities. On the other hand, the consciousness soul's own life determines the extent to which the spirit self can develop within it. The better the soul body's development, the better the sentient soul can develop its interaction with the outer world. The more the consciousness soul supplies the spirit self with nourishment, the richer and more powerful the spirit self becomes. During life, the spirit self is supplied with this nourishment through worked over and assimilated experiences, and through their fruits, as has been demonstrated. Naturally, this interaction between soul and spirit can take place only where the two intermingle, that is, in the joining of the spirit self and the consciousness soul. Let us look first at the interaction between the soul body and the sentient soul. Although, as we have seen, the soul body is the most finely fashioned aspect of our bodily nature, it still belongs to and is dependent on this bodily nature. In one respect, the physical body, the ether body, and the soul body form a totality. Therefore, the soul body is also subject to the laws of physical heredity, through which the body receives its form. But since it is the most ephemeral aspect of our physical nature, it must also show the most ephemeral manifestations of heredity. Human physical bodies differ only slightly on the basis of race, nation, and family. And although individual ether bodies vary more, they still show a great similarity. However, when it comes to the soul body, the differences are already very great. In the soul body, what we perceive as a person's external personal uniqueness is expressed. The soul body is therefore also the carrier of whatever personal uniqueness is passed down from ancestors to descendants. It is true that the soul, as has been described, leads a full and independent life of its own. It shuts itself off with its likes and dislikes, emotions and passions. It is active as a totality, however, and the sentient soul, too, bears the stamp of this totality. Thus, because the sentient soul permeates and, so to speak, fills the soul body takes shape in accordance with the nature of the soul, and is then able, through heredity, to transmit the predecessor's inclinations, passions, and so on, to the descendants. Goethe's saying, quote, "From my father I get my build and the tendency to take life seriously. From my mother my happy disposition and delight in storytelling." Close quote. Footnote in German, if I may, "Vom Vater hab ich die Statur des Lebens ernstes führen, vom Mütterchen die Frohnatur, die Lust zu fabulieren." End of footnote. Is based on this fact. But his genius, of course, did not come from either of his parents. This gives us an idea of what kinds of soul qualities are, in effect, turned over to the line of physical heredity. The substances and forces of the physical body are present in the very same way all around us in outer physical nature. We are continually taking them in from outside and giving them back again. Over the course of a few years, all the substances that make up the physical body are renewed. They are continually being renewed, yet always take on the form of a human body, because the ether body holds them together. And the ether body's form is not determined solely by processes taking place between birth or conception, and death, but is also dependent on the laws of heredity that extend beyond birth and death. Because the soul body can be influenced by the sentient soul, characteristic soul qualities can also be transmitted through the line of heredity. That is, the soul has an impact on the process of physical heredity. And what about the interaction between soul and spirit? During life, the spirit is bound to the soul in the way described earlier. From the spirit, the soul receives the gift of living in the true and the good, and this enables it to bring the spirit itself to expression in its own life, in its inclinations, drives, and passions. The spirit self brings the eternal laws of the true and the good to the capital I, from the world of the spirit. By means of our consciousness soul, these laws are linked to the soul's own individual life experiences. These experiences are transitory, but their fruits are lasting. The fact that they have been linked to the spirit self makes a lasting impression on it. If the human spirit then approaches such an experience and finds it similar to another that it has already been linked to in the past, it recognizes something familiar in it and knows that it must behave differently toward this than if it were encountering it for the first time. This is the basis of all learning. The fruits of learning are the abilities we acquire, and in this way, the fruits of our transitory life are imprinted on our immortal spirit. Are we aware of these fruits in some way? Where do those potentials described above as characteristic of the spiritual human being come from? Surely they can only be based on the various capabilities people bring with them when they set out on their earthly journey. In some respects, these capabilities are quite like the ones we can acquire during our lifetime. Take the case of a genius, for instance. As a boy, Mozart could write down from memory a long piece of music he had heard only once. He was able to do so only because he could survey the whole thing all at once, as a totality. In the course of our lifetime, we can all, at least within certain limits, broaden our capacity to gain an overview of things and to understand the relationships between them. We then possess new abilities. Lessing, for example, said that through his gift for critical observation, he had acquired something very close to genius. If we are not inclined to see such abilities rooted in inborn potential as miracles, we must see them as the fruits of what the spirit self has experienced through a soul. They have been impressed upon the spirit self. And since it did not happen in this lifetime, it must have happened in a previous one. Each human spirit is a species in its own right. Just as individual human beings pass on their characteristics, the spirit passes on its characteristics within its species, that is, within itself. In each life, the human spirit appears as a repetition of itself, with the fruits of its experiences in earlier lifetimes. Thus, this lifetime is the repetition of others, and brings with it what the spirit self has gained in its previous life. When the spirit self takes in something that can develop into fruit, it imbues itself with the life spirit. Just as the life body reproduces the form of a species from generation to generation, the life spirit reproduces the soul from one personal existence to the next. The discussion up to this point has shown the validity of the idea that certain processes in human life can be explained in terms of repeated earth lives. The full significance of this idea can be realized only through the kind of observation that stems from spiritual insights, such as those acquired by following the path to knowledge described at the end of this book. It should be pointed out that ordinary observation, properly guided by thinking, can lead us to this idea, although, to begin with, it will leave the idea in a shadow-like stage, and will not be able to defend it completely against objections that arise from imprecise observation, not properly guided by thinking. On the other hand, anyone who comes to this idea through ordinary thoughtful observation is preparing for supersensible observation by beginning to develop something we must have before supersensible observation can begin, just as we must have eyes before physical observation is possible. And people who object that by conceiving an idea like this, we could talk ourselves into believing in the reality of supersensible perception, only prove themselves incapable of really taking up the truth through independent thinking. They are talking themselves into believing their own objections. In this way, the soul's experiences become lasting, not only within the confines of birth and death, but also beyond death. But the soul imprints these experiences not only on the spirit lighting up within it, but also, by means of its actions, on the outer world, as has been pointed out. What someone did yesterday is still present today in the form of its effects. Along these lines, the metaphor of sleep and death gives us a picture of the connection between cause and effect. Sleep has often been called, quote, the younger brother of death, close quote. I get up in the morning. The continuity of my activity has been interrupted by the night. Under normal circumstances, I cannot resume my activity arbitrarily. I must link up with what I did yesterday in my life, if my life is to have any order and cohesiveness. Yesterday's actions are now the actions I must abide by in what I do today. Through what I did yesterday, I have created my destiny for today. I have disengaged myself from my own activity for a while, but it belongs to me and pulls me back again after I have withdrawn from it for a while. My past continues to be connected to me. It lives on in my present and will follow me into my future. Instead of waking up this morning, I would have to be created anew, out of nothing, if the effects of my actions from yesterday were not meant to be my destiny today. It would be as absurd as if under ordinary circumstances I had had a house built for myself and then did not move into it. But we are not created anew each morning, nor is the human spirit created anew as it starts the journey of its earthly life. We must try to understand what really does happen when we set out on this journey. A physical body makes its appearance, having received its form through the laws of heredity. This body becomes the vehicle for a spirit that is repeating an earlier life in a new form. Between the two, leading a self-contained life of its own, stands the soul. It is served by its likes and dislikes, and its wishes and desires, and places thinking in its service. As the sentient soul, it receives impressions from the outer world and carries them to the spirit, which extracts and preserves their fruits. The soul plays a mediator's role, in a sense, and its task is accomplished in playing this role satisfactorily. The body forms impressions for the soul, which reshapes them into sensations, stores them in the memory as mental images, and passes them on to the spirit to be made lasting. The soul is what actually makes us belong to this earthly life. Through the body we belong to the physical human genus. We are members of this genus. With our spirit we live in a higher world. The soul binds the two worlds together for a while. On entering the physical world, the human spirit finds itself not in an unfamiliar setting, but in one that bears the imprint of its actions. Something in this new setting belongs to the spirit, bears the stamp of its being, is related to it. Just as the soul once conveyed impressions of the outer world to the spirit, to be made lasting, it also, as the spirit's organ, transformed its spirit-given faculties into actions that in their effects are equally lasting. In doing so, the soul actually flowed into these actions. In the effects of its actions, the human soul lives on in a second independent life. This gives us grounds for examining how the processes of destiny enter into life. Something happens to us, quote, bumps into us, close quote, enters our life as if by chance, or so we tend to think at first. We can become aware, however, that each one of us is the result of many such, quote unquote, chance occurrences. If at the age of 40 I take a good look at myself and refuse to be content with an empty abstract concept of the I, capital, as I ponder my soul's essential nature, I may well conclude that I am nothing more and nothing less than what I have become through what has happened to me until now as a matter of destiny. I would probably have been a different person if, at age 20, I had had a different series of experiences than what actually did happen to me. I will then look for my I, not only in its developmental influences that come from within, but also in what exerts a formative influence on my life from outside. I will recognize my own I in what, quote, close quote, happens to me. If we give ourselves impartially to such a realization, we need to take only one more step in intimately observing life before we can see in what comes to us through certain experiences of destiny something that takes hold of the I from outside, just as memory works from inside to allow past experiences to light up again. In this way, we can become able to recognize an experience of destiny as a past action of the soul finding its way to the I, just as a memory is a past experience that is re-invoked by outer circumstances and finds its way into our minds as a mental image. The idea that the results of its own actions may meet the soul again has already been discussed as a possibility, see pages 66 forward. However, a meeting of this sort cannot come about within the confines of a single life on earth, because this life has been organized and prepared in such a way as to bring about the action in question. The experience is intertwined with the accomplishment of the action. It is as impossible for a specific consequence of this action to return to the soul as it is for us to remember an experience when we are still in the middle of it. Rather, what comes into question here is our experience of consequences that meet the I when it does not have the aptitudes it had during the lifetime in which the action was performed. That is, it is only possible to focus on consequences that come from other earthly lives. As soon as we sense that some apparently coincidental experience is as closely related to the I as anything that takes shape out of the inner being of the I, we can only conclude that in such an experience of destiny, we are confronting consequences that come from earlier lives on earth. As we can see, an intimate, thought-guided approach to life leads us to adopt the idea, (paradoxical as it may seem to our ordinary consciousness, that what we experience as destiny in one lifetime is related to our actions in previous earthly lives. Once again, the full import of this idea can be realized only through supersensible knowledge, without which it remains shadow-like at best. But here, too, the idea acquired by means of ordinary consciousness prepares our soul for witnessing its full truth through genuine supersensible perception. However, only one part of my action is out in the world. The other part is in me. We can take a simple parallel from the field of biology to clarify the relationship between an I, capital, and its actions. In certain caves in Kentucky are animals that were able to see when they first ventured in, but have lost their sight through prolonged living in darkness. Their eyes have stopped functioning. The physical and chemical activity taking place during seeing no longer happens in them, and the stream of nutrients that once supported this activity has been redirected to other organs. By now, these animals can live only in caves. Through their original action, migrating into the caves, they have determined the conditions under which they must now live. Their migration has become a part of their destiny or fate. A being that was active in the past has linked itself to the results of its own actions. It is the same with the human spirit. Only by being active could the soul transmit certain capabilities to the spirit. These capabilities correspond directly to actions. An action that the soul has carried out gives it the strength and potential to carry out another action, which is the direct fruit of the first. The soul carries this around as an inner necessity until the second action has been completed. We could also say that through an action, the need to carry out its consequence is impressed on the soul. Through its actions, each human spirit has truly prepared its own destiny. It finds itself linked in each new lifetime to what it did in the previous one. We may wonder how that could possibly be, since the reincarnating spirit finds itself in a world totally different from the one it left behind. The way we conceive of the chain of destiny when we ask such a question, however, clings to quite external and superficial aspects of life. If my field of activity is shifted from Europe to America, I will also find myself in totally new surroundings, and yet my life in America will still be quite dependent on how I used to live in Europe. If I was a mechanic in Europe, my life in America will take shape quite differently than it would if I was a banker. In the first instance, I will probably be surrounded by machinery again in America. In the second, by the trappings of the banking business. In each case, my former life determines my surroundings. It extracts from the entire surrounding world those things that are related to it, so to speak. It is the same with the spirit self. in a new life, it is obliged to surround itself with things it is related to from its previous life. That is why sleep is a helpful image for death, because during sleep we are also withdrawn from the arena in which our destiny awaits for us. While we are sleeping, events in this arena continue without us, and for a while we have no influence on the course they take. Nevertheless, how we live the next day still depends on the effects of what we did the day before. In reality, our personalities are re-embodied anew each morning in the world of our actions. It is as if what we were separated from during the night is spread out around us during the day. The same holds true for the actions we carried out in earlier incarnations. They are bound to us as our destiny, just as dwelling in dark caves is bound to the animals who lost their sense of sight through migrating into those caves. Just as these animals can live only in the surroundings in which they now find themselves, surroundings into which they have inserted themselves, a human spirit can live only in the environment it has created for itself through its own actions. The ongoing course of events sees to it that when I wake in the morning, I find myself in a situation that I myself created the previous day. Similarly, my reincarnating spirit's relationship to the objects in their surroundings sees to it that I enter an environment corresponding to my actions in the previous life. From the above, we can form an idea of how the soul is incorporated into the overall organization of a human being. The physical body is subject to the laws of heredity. The human spirit, on the other hand, must reincarnate over and over again, and its laws consists in having to carry the fruits of previous lifetimes over into the following ones. Our souls live in the present, although this life in the present is not independent of our previous lives, since each incarnating spirit brings its destiny along with it from previous incarnations, and this destiny determines its present life. What impressions our souls will be capable of receiving, which of our desires can be fulfilled, what joys and sorrows will be our lot, what other human beings we will meet, all this depends on what our actions were like in earlier incarnations of the spirit. People to whom our souls were connected in one lifetime will necessarily encounter us again in a later one, because the actions that took place between us must have their consequences. Souls that have once been associated will venture into reincarnation at the same time. Thus the life of the soul is a product of the spirit's self-created destiny. The course of a human life within the framework of life and death is determined in three different ways, and we are also, therefore, dependent on three factors that go beyond birth and death. The body is subject to the laws of heredity. The soul is subject to self-created destiny, or, to use an ancient term, to its karma. And the spirit is subject to the laws of reincarnation, or repeated earthly lives. The interrelationship of body, soul, and spirit can also be expressed as follows. The spirit is immortal. Birth and death govern our bodily existence in accordance with the laws of the physical world. And the life of the soul, which is subject to destiny, mediates between body and spirit during the course of an earthly life. These three worlds to which we belong will be the subject of the next section of this book, since some familiarity with them is a prerequisite for all further knowledge of the essential nature of the human being. If our way of thinking comes to grips with life's phenomena, and does not hesitate to follow thoughts resulting from living vital observation through to their final ramifications, we can indeed arrive at the idea of repeated earthly lives and the law of destiny through mere logic. It is true that for a seer with opened spiritual eyes, past lives are present as a direct experience, like reading from an open book. But it is equally true that the truth of all of this can come to light for anyone with an active, observant, reasoning ability. That is the end of chapter 2, and here is an addendum. The statements in this chapter on reincarnation and karma attempt to convey the extent to which human life and destiny point in and of themselves to the idea of repeated earth lives. The intent was to do so by thoughtfully considering the course of human life without referring to the spiritual scientific ideas presented in other chapters. Of course, the very idea of reincarnation and karma will seem rather questionable to anyone who accepts only ideas that assume the existence of only a single earthly life as being well-founded. However, the intention of this chapter is to show that such ideas cannot lead to an understanding of why a person's life takes a particular course. In that case, we are forced to look for different ideas, which may appear to contradict our usual ones. The only reason for not looking for them would be a fundamental refusal on our part to apply the same thoughtful consideration with which we investigate physical processes to processes that can be grasped only inwardly. This refusal would mean, for instance, that we belittle the fact that our experience of a stroke of destiny bears a resemblance to what we experience when our memory encounters an event related to something we actually recollect. But if we try to see how a stroke of destiny is really experienced, we can distinguish between the real state of affairs and what can be said about such an experience from a merely external point of view that denies any vital connection between this stroke of destiny and our capital I. From this point of view, a stroke of destiny appears to be either a coincidence or something determined from outside. And since, in fact, some strokes of destiny actually are making their first impact on a human life, so to speak, and only show their results later on, the temptation is all the greater to generalize from such instances without taking any other possibility into account. We begin to consider other possibilities only once life has educated our cognitive abilities and brought them into line with what Goethe's friend Knebel once wrote in a letter. Quote, "On close observation, we will find that most people's lives contain a plan that seems laid out for them either in their own character or in the circumstances that guide them. No matter how changeable and varied their situations may be, in the end a certain wholeness or inner coherence is apparent. The hand of a special fate, no matter how hidden its working, is still clearly to be seen, whether moved by outer causes or by inner impulses. Often, in fact, we are moved in its direction for quite conflicting reasons. No matter how confused the course of a life may be, a plan and a direction still show through." Close quote. Footnote: Carl Ludwig von Knebel, 1744-1834. This letter appears in K. Elvers Knebel's Literarischer Nachlass und Briefwechsel, his literary legacy and correspondence. End of footnote. Raising objections to an observation of this sort is easy, especially for people unwilling to consider the inner experiences it stems from. However, the author of this book believes that in what he has said about destiny and repeated earth lives, he has accurately delineated the boundaries within which it is possible to form conceptions about the causes shaping human life. He has pointed out that the conviction to which these thoughts lead is only sketchily defined by them, that all they can do is prepare us in thought for what must ultimately be discovered by means of spiritual research. In itself, however, as long as this thought preparation does not exaggerate its own importance or attempt to prove anything, but only trains our soul, it entails an inner effort that can make us unbiased and receptive to facts we would simply take for foolish without it. End of addendum and final end of chapter 2 of Theosophy.